September 2008. Lehman Brothers implodes. Markets freeze. Within hours, the panic spreads from Manhattan to Frankfurt to Shanghai. At the United Nations, world leaders scramble to make sense of what's happening. The Philippines president calls it a terrible tsunami. Argentina's leader points out the bitter irony. After decades of America lecturing the world about fiscal discipline, it's now implementing the biggest government intervention in memory. French President Sarkozy declares the end of American financial dominance. What seemed like a housing bubble in Nevada has somehow threatened to collapse the entire global economy. For years, economists warned about America's mounting trade deficits and dependence on foreign funding, especially from China. The nightmare scenario involved foreign creditors losing faith in the dollar, triggering a painful adjustment. But when catastrophe struck, it came from an unexpected direction, not from treasury bonds or trade imbalances, but from ordinary mortgages packaged into complex securities that almost no one fully understood. What made 2008 so shocking was how a humdrum real estate downturn nearly destroyed the world economy. The transmission mechanism wasn't foreign governments dumping American debt. Instead, European banks had become deeply entangled in America's mortgage machine. For decades, American banks took deposits and made mortgages they kept. The 1980s shattered this model. When Volcker's interest rate shock devastated savings and loans, Reagan chose deregulation, unleashing securitization, packaging mortgages into pools sold to investors nationwide. Between 2004 and 2006, private securitization exploded to $1 trillion annually, 10 times 2001 levels. Investment banks built complete pipelines, originating loans specifically to feed their machines. Financial engineering transformed low-rated debt into AAA securities. By 2004, half of subprime mortgages had incomplete or zero documentation. 30% were interest-only loans to borrowers with no realistic repayment prospect. Brokers earned fees for volume, not quality. Investment banks collected fees regardless of future performance. Rating agencies, paid by the banks they rated, provided favorable ratings. Yield-hungry investors worldwide eagerly bought these supposedly safe securities. When housing prices fell in 2006 and adjustable rates reset higher, defaults became inevitable. The financial engineering meant to distribute risk had instead concentrated it in the shadow banking system's most vulnerable corners. When America's mortgage meltdown spread, European leaders dismissed it as uniquely American dysfunction. Germany's finance minister declared America would forfeit its financial superpower status. France's president proclaimed laissez-faire is finished. This narrative proved catastrophically wrong. European banks had eagerly embraced America's securitized mortgage system. By 2008, Europeans held 29% of high-risk mortgage-backed securities and backed a third of newly issued private label securities at the 2006 peak. Most critically, they dominated asset-backed commercial paper, the weakest link, with two-thirds having European sponsors. Unlike China's currency-stabilizing treasury purchases, European banks simply borrowed dollars to lend dollars. London emerged as the crucial second node, handling 35% of global foreign exchange and 43% of interest rate derivatives by 2007. Deutsche Bank, UBS, and Barclays operated with leverage exceeding 40 to 1, while American competitors averaged 20 to 1. European banks faced a staggering $1.3 trillion funding gap by 2007. When trust evaporated, they couldn't roll over their dollar borrowing. The crisis wasn't too many dollars. It was an acute dollar shortage threatening to freeze the entire system. A mortgage default in Nevada could threaten Frankfurt banks as directly as those in New York. Tuesday, September 16, 2008, the day after Lehman collapsed, global money markets seized up. Northern Rock, a British bank with minimal subprime exposure, exemplified the contagion. It had quintupled its balance sheet between 1998 and 2007, funding 80% through wholesale money markets rather than deposits. When BNP Paribas froze interbank lending on August 9, 2007, Northern Rock notified regulators just 2 days later. Bear Stearns faced an unprecedented run on repo. Despite legal protections for repo collateral in bankruptcy, counterparties fled. By March 13, 2008, Bear's liquidity plummeted from $18 billion to $2 billion. After Lehman fell, AIG became the next domino, holding $2.7 trillion in derivatives, including $527 billion in credit default swaps. Losing its top credit rating triggered immediate collateral demands. The final break was money market funds. On September 16th, Reserve Primary Fund couldn't guarantee dollar-for-dollar returns. Though losses proved minimal, $500 billion fled to treasuries within days. Beyond Manhattan and London, devastation spread globally through factory closures and market collapses. During the crisis, the Federal Reserve became the world's lender of last resort, providing trillions in liquidity to banks across the US, Europe, and Asia. This unprecedented intervention redefined global finance while remaining largely hidden from public view. The dollar shortage exposed dangerous vulnerabilities. Germany's monthly trade surplus with the US was roughly $5 billion, yet European banks needed to refinance over $2 trillion in dollar funding. The Fed deployed multiple facilities targeting shadow banking. The term auction facility provided $6.18 trillion in short-term funds, with foreign banks taking over 50%. Swap lines with foreign central banks reached $10 trillion, with the ECB as the largest beneficiary. The intervention's secrecy was remarkable. When Congress asked who received swap line money, Chairman Bernanke could truthfully reply, "I don't know." Ultimate recipients weren't under American oversight. Full records emerged only after legislation and a Supreme Court case in late 2010. This hidden support contradicted calls for reducing dollar dependence. The crisis didn't relativize the dollar. It dramatically reasserted the Fed's pivotal role in global finance. By early 2010, Greece's debt crisis forced a choice: restructuring or bailout. European banks held 90 billion euros in Greek debt, pension funds another 90 billion. Restructuring would relieve Greece, but trigger panic. European banks had $2.5 trillion in loans to the Eurozone periphery, risking contagion to Portugal, Ireland, Spain, and Italy. The solution was extend and pretend. A troika of the EU, ECB, and IMF would dictate policy to Greece, paying off existing debt through new loans. Greece agreed to slash its deficit, an 18% GDP turnaround with 7.5% coming in 2010 alone, in exchange for 110 billion euros. On May 5th, as Merkel declared the rescue inevitable, Greece erupted in strikes and riots that left three bank employees dead. By July 2012, the crisis reached its breaking point. Draghi's "whatever it takes" speech on July 26th became the turning point. Speaking in London, he declared the ECB ready to do whatever necessary to preserve the euro, catching even ECB officials by surprise. Merkel, Monti, and Hollande issued joint statements affirming their commitment, finally ending the acute phase of the crisis. While technocrats celebrated preventing another Great Depression, millions felt profound betrayal. Banks received taxpayer bailouts while ordinary people lost homes, jobs, and savings. By summer 2011, trust in government had collapsed to 11%. The small Occupy Wall Street encampment captured global attention. A poll revealed nearly half of Americans felt it reflected mainstream views. In Europe, the perception that the welfare state was being dismantled to satisfy bankers provoked widespread outrage. On May 15, 2011, 20,000 Spanish protesters occupied Madrid's Puerta del Sol, declaring, "We are not goods in the hands of politicians and bankers." This politics of resentment reshaped elections. In 2016, British voters chose Brexit and Americans elected Donald Trump, both campaigns channeling popular anger against elites and globalization. Despite campaign rhetoric against Goldman Sachs, Trump filled key positions with Goldman alumni. Within 48 hours of inauguration, he withdrew from the Trans-Pacific Partnership and announced plans to renegotiate NAFTA, reversing America's decades-long commitment to multilateral trade. At Treasury Secretary Mnuchin's first G20 meeting in March 2017, the group couldn't even agree to resist all forms of protectionism. The financial crisis had fractured the post-war liberal order.